You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with journalist and author Rachel Shabi. Rachel, what stories are we going to be looking at today?
We're going to be looking at the spiraling carnage in Iraq, the insurgency, possibly, in the Sinai Desert in Egypt, and the zombie peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians.
Excellent stuff, Rachel. Also on the programme...
Surely 4 weeks before an election, he can stop being evasive about where the $70 billion worth of cuts to jobs, to health and education
but
would
Prime
fall.
But, Prime Minister, the numbers the have moved around that, a lot. The numbers have moved around a lot.
Australia's first televised debate was yesterday. Tony Abbott and Prime Minister Kevin Rudd confronted each other on education, spending cuts, and the GST. We'll see who came out on top.
And we'll speak to the director of a new documentary on Tibet. It's called When the Dragon Swallowed the Sun, and it was 7 years in the making.
My father, he used to tell me stories about his own land, filled with mountains, pastures. Below that is the town. Basically, life in tranquility. Peace.
All that plus, we'll also be checking in with our correspondent in Madrid. We'll leaf through this morning's British front pages with our editor, Andrew Tuck. And we'll even play some music, too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
A lot to look forward to, but first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
Supporters of the ousted Egyptian president Mohamed Morsi are preparing for a renewed attempt to break up protest camps in Cairo. Authorities have suggested they'll move against the sit-ins today. But the Muslim Brotherhood, which continues to demand Mr. Morsi's reinstatement, has warned of the risk of further violence. More than 250 people have died since the military moved against Mr. Morsi at the beginning of July. Israel's government has approved the release of 26 long-term Palestinian prisoners ahead of the resumption of peace talks. That move followed Palestinian complaints at Israel's decision to approve the building of almost 1,200 new settlement homes. Meanwhile, ahead of the new talks, Israel has criticized the EU for taking its own position on the negotiations. Justice Minister Tzipi Livni says it's for both sides in the talks to work out a solution.
This is an opportunity to say that the future borders of Israel and the future Palestinian state would be discussed and agreed in the negotiations room between Israel and the Palestinian, and not as an EU decision, as we saw in the guidelines that the EU published a few weeks ago.
Pakistan has accused India of firing shells across the disputed border between the two countries. Tensions remain high in Kashmir after the killing last week of 5 Indian soldiers. Now Pakistan says a civilian died when Indian forces launched shells across the border. A member of the French military is being held on suspicion of plotting to attack a mosque. France's Interior Ministry says the 23-year-old, who is based near Lyon, planned to target a mosque in the city. It's claimed the attack was meant to coincide with the end of Ramadan. More US embassies are due to reopen today in the Middle East and North Africa. 20 were shut down a week ago after a terror alert. The embassies in Yemen and the Pakistani city of Lahore will remain closed for the moment. The family of a British citizen who was murdered in China is demanding compensation from his killer. The wife of former top politician Bo Xilai was jailed for life for the killing of the businessman Neil Haywood. The case triggered an investigation into claims of corruption. Bo Xilai is now awaiting trial, accused of taking bribes. Analysts in Japan say the country's latest growth figures are disappointing. Gross domestic product grew by 0.6% between April and June, and over the past 12 months, the rise was 2.6%, which is below many predictions. An expert on climate change is warning urgent moves are needed to protect large parts of Africa. Predictions suggest a significant rise in temperatures across large parts of the continent. Amani Dampa, who is an expert on the issue with the African Union, says until now, few in African governments have taken the issue seriously.
Africa is seriously facing, is suffering from the negative impact of climate change. And then this negative impact also extends to the wildlife sector. As you know, wildlife is of great economic importance.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul. It is 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London, where the time is 8:05 in the morning. It's time now to set the day's agenda with the three key stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Rachel Shabby, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Rachel, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm very well. Good morning.
Shall we begin with a story out of Iraq, a horrible month when it comes to death toll there?
A horrible few months when it comes to the death toll. It's thought that at least 3,000 have died since April. And these are just appalling, appalling deaths. You probably remember at some point in June, there were 18 car bombs triggered to go off across Iraq on the same day. Just the other day, 9 school kids were killed in the street while playing football. And the escalating type and level of killing in Iraq is becoming absolutely horrendous. And of course, part of the reason for that is that it is that the Syrian war and the Iraq war are becoming one and the same thing. It's the same insurgents. It's sort of al-Qaeda-backed insurgents in both, Sunni-led insurgencies that are responsible for the killings in both countries. One is inspiring the other. One is training in preparation for the other. It's almost as though they've become one and the same thing.
So does that mean those worrying that Iraq is descending back into civil war are missing the point that actually it's much bigger than that, cross-border?
Absolutely. It's way bigger than that. I mean, Iraq, it was never going to be okay given the state that it was left in following the US-led invasion in 2003 and in the aftermath of that, you know, essentially hollowing out a state, destroying a government, destroying its political, social and security infrastructure. There was no thought to the consequences of that war, and Iraq is continuing to pay the price for doing that to a nation. Of course, a nation left in that state is not going to be able to, you know, spring back to normality. But yes, it is absolutely being compounded by the situation in Syria, and it places even greater responsibility on the need to resolve the Syrian crisis.
How much is al-Qaeda behind some of the recent attacks? It's confusing to me if anyone is taking overall responsibility for this resurgence in violence.
Well, al-Qaeda in Iraq is taking responsibility for this insurgency. Certainly, I mean, it's had a lot of wins, if we can call them that, in the region in the past few months. It was a pretty spectacular jailbreak.
A jailbreak at Abu Ghraib prison.
Absolutely. Hundreds of prisoners released from there. Quite a victory for al-Qaeda. And it is also claiming responsibility for a component of the opposition in Syria. And of course, the trouble is that that's the very opposition that the US is backing in Syria, but opposing in Iraq. Mm. So it's a huge contradiction. A massive mess, and something that obviously needs to be sorted out as soon
as possible. And of course, the sectarian violence is between the Shia and the Sunnis. Is there a political solution to this conflict?
Well, the political solution, what's been happening is that the talks that have been proposed in Geneva to de-escalate the spiraling situation in Syria are stalling because the US is refusing Russia's not unreasonable request to get Iran involved. Iran is obviously supporting the governments in both Iraq and Syria and would have to be engaged. But the US has so far refused that, which means that there is no chance of negotiating a way out of this crisis.
Rachel, take us on to the next story you're looking at. Israel's announcement about building more than 1,000 new settlement homes, of course, in the run-up to long-anticipated peace talks.
Yeah, I mean, this was announced, as you say, days before peace talks are convened to resume in Jerusalem on
Wednesday. Is that timing done explicitly?
It's interesting.
It doesn't make sense.
What's the intention? It does seem mind-boggling, doesn't it, on the eve of negotiations that Israel would go ahead and announce this.
Yeah. Do we know the intention for this?
Mind-boggling is a very, very delicate way of putting it. Haaretz, the leading liberal newspaper in Israel, said it would be hard to conclude anything other than that the Israeli government is doing its best to sabotage the peace talks. I mean, why would you look at the situation and see it any differently? It's announced, you know, the biggest plans to construct on settlements, you know, for quite a long time. It's also reneged on the terms of the prisoner release that was scheduled today. There was obviously another condition of the peace talks resuming. You know, it seems to be going out of its way to try to goad the Palestinians into saying, we cannot reconvene the peace talks on this basis. And then, of course, the Palestinians will, you know, will be blamed for making the peace talks fail.
And John Kerry, of course, who's the man really leading these negotiations, along with Martin Indyk, putting a lot of his political capital behind this. How shocked do you think they were by this move by Israel? Because lots of people saying that they were left in the dark and they were viewing this as a complete surprise as well.
Well, I think it's quite convenient for people to say that they were shocked. Netanyahu is also saying that he was shocked, you know, and it's very easy for people to kind of imagine that, you know, this is a really complicated situation. Netanyahu has in his cabinet people who are doing things against his will, and he's a bit, well, I didn't know. I can't stop them. And it's very convenient. We need to remember that the US was responsible for this situation in the first place. The last time peace talks broke down, it was because the US backed down on a very delicate insistence on asking Israel to freeze settlement construction, which Israel refused to do. So in that context, how seriously can we take the US efforts to reconvene peace talks if it's not prepared to step up and enforce that with penalties and consequences?
Rachel, these talks were due to resume this week, midweek. Is there any time to salvage them? They haven't officially been called off yet, have they?
They haven't officially been called off. The Palestinians are obviously suggesting that it's going to be very hard for them to resume those talks, in particular because, you know, to compound this settlement plan announcement, there's also the prisoner release today, which is not according to the terms agreed. Israel has decided that it is may expel various Palestinian prisoners or release them into Gaza. And Palestinians are saying, well, we didn't agree to that. You know, we want you to release West Bank Palestinians into the West Bank. Thanks very much. We didn't agree for them to be expelled. So those two things compounded make it very, very difficult for the Palestinians to stick to this plan.
And when these negotiations were first announced, many people were very optimistic at the situation. Many people viewed them very hopeful that things could actually be done. Looking at what's kind of happened over the last 2 weeks, and of course, you cover this part of the world quite extensively. What's your prediction then? Are peace talks still possible? Is it still hope that there might be some resolution at the end of the tunnel?
I mean, I think it's very frustrating when you have been covering this region for a while, and when a round of peace talks is announced, everybody gets a bit kumbaya about it. It's all like, let's give peace a chance. Don't scupper it with your cynicism. And you know, you're actually thinking, well, you know, we're not being cynical just for the fun of it. We have very good grounds to see this as a process that is just a fig leaf for Israel to continue its settlement expansion. It takes the international heat off Israel when it says that it will take part in these peace talks. But actually, it's not doing anything in the background that would persuade us that it is serious about these talks. Israel prefers endless peace talks to an actual solution, and that's always been the problem.
Rachel, let's move on to the next story. And what's going on in Sinai? Most of the world focused on Cairo, but not to be missed, terrifying attacks in Sinai.
Yeah, absolutely. The last few months have seen really bad attacks in the Sinai, attacks against Christians as well, which is a very worrying situation. A lot of Christians talking about maybe having to leave the area. This is something that has been bubbling since the ouster of deposed President Mohamed Morsi. Various components to it. On the one hand, Islamists in the Sinai are saying, well, You know, this is what happens. You democratically elect an Islamist president and they're deposed. Therefore, violence is the answer. And then there's another strain that says, well, we absolutely reject the fact that he's been deposed by a military coup. And this is our way of protesting that. And of course, Islamist militants will, you know, this is a sort of opportunistic time for them, the sort of instability and uncertainty in the region and perhaps the taking advantage of that. But of course, it comes under the backdrop of the Sinai being a problematic area for some time. It has been disadvantaged, ignored, infrastructure is rubbish, you know, so that's the kind of breeding ground for the sort of resentment that has been, you know, historic in that region.
And this isn't just an Egyptian problem. The Israelis are also getting involved. They launched joint attacks, the Israelis and the Egyptians. Do you think there's any potential or possibility that the Egyptian-Israeli peace accord could potentially be damaged by these attacks?
Well, it's one of the terms of that peace accord that that Sinai region is patrolled, and Israel actually controls the terms by which it is patrolled. So if the Egyptian army wants to come into that region, it needs Israeli permission to do so. There's been a lot of denial of the sort of involvement. We heard a few weeks ago that there were Israeli drone strikes in the Sinai. Israel, of course, swiftly denied that because that would be quite dodgy to go into Egyptian airspace. The Egyptians would obviously find that very embarrassing too. So there's been a lot of back and forth and denial, but it's safe to assume that the two sides are coordinating on to how, as to how to deal with this problem, because it's a problem that affects both countries.
Great to have you here, Rachel. Thank you. Rachel Shabi, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands.
Coming up, we'll be in Australia for the latest political drama between Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott. Stay tuned.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time. And you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes. Oh, and the answers are knit, yes, ask the Japanese, San Francisco, where else, the Caracas poor on the up, and a greener than thou Malmo hood. Urbanist listeners, don't look too smug. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge. The time is 17:17 in Canberra. It's 8:17 here in London, but it is to Australia where we're headed next. It was the debate that many people were waiting for. The last time Prime Minister Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott met was during the 2010 election campaign. And as we all know, Kevin Rudd was the victor. Well, fast forward 3 years and the race is even closer this time around, with most polls showing Tony Abbott and his Liberal Party out in front.
So there was even more expectation from Kevin Rudd to re-energize his campaign, which many political pundits say has been limping along recently. So with the two men arguing their positions on everything from education, the carbon tax, the GST, and cuts to spending, who came out on top? Well, to answer that question, joining us now is Bernard Keane, the Canberra correspondent of Crikey. Bernard, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Now, like any one-on-one duel, people want to know who the victor was. Was there a clear winner?
Well, look, I don't think so. Look, Kevin Rudd probably came out marginally ahead, but Tony Abbott, as you pointed out in your introduction, is the front runner in this campaign, and he didn't do anything to endanger that status. So Kevin Rudd really needed to produce some sort of comprehensive victory, or Tony Abbott needed to produce a startling gaffe to really change the dynamic of this election campaign, and that certainly wasn't on offer last night. In fact, the overall tone of it was extraordinarily flat. It was less a debate, shall we say, and more a kind of a joint press conference in which they separately answered questions. But there was very little interaction between the candidates, and that's what I think a lot of Australian voters would have wanted to see was some actual interaction between the candidates, and that was uh, there was very, very little of that.
Well, as we mentioned in our intro, the last time these two men met were back in 2010 for that debate back during the last election campaign. Many people applauded Kevin Rudd for acting prime ministerial, Tony Abbott a bit more negatively, but lots of people asking questions about why Kevin Rudd this time around seemed a lot more nervous than he did back in 2010. You know, there's this whole controversy now about whether he had access to notes at the pedestal. Many people saying he shouldn't have been allowed to have these notes. What was it about Kevin Rudd, do you think, that came across so differently from his 2010 performance?
Well, the story is a little bit complicated because Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott did debate in the lead up to the 2010 election over the specific issue of health, which was quite a significant issue back in that election campaign. Kevin Rudd was then removed from the prime ministership and replaced by Julia Gillard, who subsequently went up against Tony Abbott in the formal debate during the election campaign. But you're right to sort of note the comparison between last night's performance and the one that Kevin Rudd produced in 2010. Rudd was very clever in 2010. He invited Tony Abbott to debate him on health. Tony Abbott showed up in effect for a kind of a gladiatorial clash. And Kevin Rudd was played the peacemaker, saying health was too important to be beset by partisan politics. We needed a new kind of approach, and that left Tony Abbott looking like an aggressive, over-aggressive guy who had no ideas. Now, Rudd tried a little bit of that last night. One of his campaign themes has been about the need for a new kind of politics that will enable Australia to cope with the challenges of the end of the mining boom here. But it hasn't been a particularly strong theme for Rudd. And I think one of the problems that he's got is that now that he's cleaned up a lot of the legacy issues that he inherited from Julia Gillard, there's a big question mark over just where he goes from here. Is he about more of the same, or does he offer something that's genuinely new? And that I think his campaign is caught somewhere between those themes, whereas Tony Abbott's campaign theme is a lot simpler. His campaign theme is... we need a change, and I'm the real change, not this kind of faux change from Julia Gillard to Kevin Rudd that Labor is offering.
And last night, Bernard, he also mentioned, Kevin Rudd, that he would introduce a gay marriage bill into Parliament within his first 100 days as Prime Minister. Did that do anything to re-energise his campaign, which, as Poppy mentioned, seems to be kind of flagging along?
Yeah, look, that was a surprise, that commitment. Kevin Rudd's a relatively recent convert to the issue of same-sex marriage. The polls here in Australia consistently show a majority of support for removing impediments to same-sex marriage. And we knew that Rudd had changed his mind on the issue of same-sex marriage. He'd come around to supporting it. What we didn't expect, and this is why it was a surprise, was Rudd undertaking to bring forward a bill, a piece of legislation within the first 100 days if he was re-elected.
So a small surprise there, Bernard. I'm sorry, but I think we'll have to leave it there. Great to have you. Bernard Keane, Crikey's Canberra correspondent. Thanks for joining us today.
Now, it took 7 years to make. The documentary When the Dragon Swallowed the Sun is an in-depth analysis on Tibet, on why it hasn't been freed yet, and other issues involving the Tibetan cause. Well, director Dirk Simon gave us an insightful look at the Tibetan movement, and the film features names involved in the cause such as Richard Gere, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and of course the 14th Dalai Lama. It also includes an original soundtrack by Philip Glass.
Well, before we came on air, Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the director of the documentary, Dirk Simon.
My father, he used to tell me stories about his own land filled with mountains, pastures. Below that is the town. Basically, life in tranquility, peace. Everything got spoiled in the year 1949 when the Red Chinese first started to invade.
My first question to you is, how long did it take to make this documentary? I worked on the film for 7 years. So basically from the very first idea to completion, it took us 7 years to make it.
That's quite a lot. So, and I know there's quite a lot of big figures involved in the film. You know, there's Richard Gere, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Dalai Lama itself, and also the music of the film, which involved Philip Glass, Damien Rice, Tony York. How those big names got involved in the film?
Well, Desmond Tutu and Richard Gere were more or less people we met on the road. I reached out to Richard Gere before, but he was too busy. But we met on the road anyway. And the musicians, once we had completed filming, we cut the trailer together and reached out to a few musicians, because the idea from the beginning was to create a film that has a high emotional impact. And I always think that music is an important part of a film. So, and fortunately, Tom York and Damien Rice and some others, and including Philip Glass, they responded to that call and said they would love to work with us.
Did you have any sort of connection with Tibet before you started the film, or you had this kind of cliche idea of Tibet?
In a way, I had no connection. So in a way, there was also a cliche idea. But I think with my own background growing up in East Germany and under communism, I felt there might be some common structures in China. And then with my own story escaping from East Germany, I felt like I can sympathize, you know, with a nation that feels occupied and oppressed. So then getting interested into Buddhism when I was around 20, I just wanted to make a film that dives deeper into the subject matter and explores a little bit what is behind the cliche. And so certainly the film took me on a journey as well, and the story developed into a direction that I didn't anticipate.
When was the first time you went to Tibet?
Ironically, 2008, at a time when no one was really going there. I tried a few times, it never worked out for different reasons. And then during the Olympics, when no one was really getting any permits to go there, that's when I managed to get there with a small crew, and we were filming in Lhasa.
So when you went to Tibet, what was the first impression you had of the country?
It was a very emotional reaction, and I'm not sure if it was simply because I anticipated it so much and I tried so many times to get there, and then finally it worked out, if there was something real. But after reading so much about it and watching all the films and then finally being there, I felt deeply moved. And it was strange that no one was really there, or no Westerners. And there was a huge presence by Chinese military. It was like martial law. And the Tibetan people that looked at us, I thought it feels like people were, in a way, they were happy to see us, so that still someone comes and tries to get there and to see. And at the same time, you could feel the pain and the oppression in their face. So it was really with a lot of mixed feelings.
Why do you think there were no Westerns? Do you think, especially because it was 2008, the year of the Beijing Olympics, people were kind of scared of China, of being in a bad relationship with China?
Well, there was the uprising in early 2008, and basically the Chinese government stopped issuing those travel permits, and they didn't want anyone there. And of course, it's not only rumors, but that's what travelers that's the answers they get when they do a little bit of research, and then people tell them, no, there are no travel permits right now, you don't even have to try. I tried to get there without a permit, so we got stopped basically just short before departure for Lhasa. So we almost got there, but then I was really, really curious how much I can push it, and then I found actually a way. And we did get the permit. I found the right person, and then we flew to Lhasa just 24 hours later.
In their minds, there were always this kind of hope that any minute they might go back, you know. But that is not there now, you see.
How do you see the situation in Tibet in the future? Are you kind of positive, or do you think it's almost impossible to get the freedom they want?
I think the future is still has to be written, but I think China will not give up on Tibet. I think that's a reality we really have to consider. It's far too important for their strategic plans. So if we want to change something, then I think we need to change our strategy, because, I mean, there has been a very active movement for many decades and there has been no change.
How effective is that movement? I was going to ask you that.
I think it has been effective to a certain degree, informing a few more people, no doubt. But I think in real political progress, I think there has been far too little development. There are a few nations where people seem to be more aware of the topic or the issue of Tibet. But I think still fighting the fight here in the West is not going to solve the issue.
Do you know if the Dalai Lama saw your documentary?
I'm not 100% sure if he saw it because I never gave him a copy. I always wanted to give him one in person. So I haven't had a chance yet. I know that people have asked me to arrange for so that he gets to see it.
Of course, he's the most influential figure in the country. But do you think some people just follow what he does? Do you think there might be other ways as well to put this Tibet cause worldwide, not only related to the Dalai Lama?
Absolutely. I think people should start thinking for themselves and stop making excuses. And the Dalai Lama himself has been trying to encourage people to make decisions on their own and to take their own or take the destiny in their own hands. But of course, you know, for centuries, that's the way they used to live. They simply followed. You know, the Dalai Lama, he is a manifestation of a goddess. And whatever he says, whatever he decides is right, that's what they truly believe. So why would they want to make a decision on themselves?
I have a final question. What are your next projects? Do you think you're still going to do something on Tibet or you want to move to something else?
I want to do more on China. I think China is also a country that is changing. That might perhaps be the biggest opportunity here, the biggest possibility.
I am a son of that Tibet. And that Tibet is calling us. Come on, my son.
A clip there from the film When the Dragon Swallowed the Sun, the director Dirk Simon there speaking to Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And of course, that film will be released to UK cinemas on the 16th of August.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll check in with our Madrid correspondent, and then we hear from British novelist Adam Thirlwell about his new book experiment called Multiples.
Whereas normally your normal model of translation would be obviously that you're dealing with the original.
Uh-huh.
In this case, only the first translator in every series was working with the original French or Russian or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else was working from a translation of a translation or a translation of a translation of a translation and so on.
But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Supporters of Egypt's ousted President Mohamed Morsi say they're preparing for a renewed attempt to break up protest camps they've set up in Cairo. Authorities have suggested they will move today against the sit-ins, but the Muslim Brotherhood, which continues to demand Mr. Morsi's reinstatement, has warned there's a risk of further violence. Israel's government's approved the release of 26 long-term Palestinian prisoners ahead of the planned resumption of peace talks. That move followed Palestinian complaints over Israel's decision to approve the building of almost 1,200 new settlement homes. Pakistan accuses India of firing shells across the disputed border between the two countries this morning. Tensions remain high in Kashmir after the killing last week of 5 Indian soldiers. Pakistan says a civilian died in the latest Indian attack. More US embassies are due to reopen today in the Middle East and North Africa. 20 were shut down a week ago after a terror alert. The embassies in Yemen and the Pakistani city of Lahore remaining closed. And analysts in Japan say the country's latest growth figures are disappointing. Gross domestic product grew by 0.6% between April and June. Over the past 12 months, the rise was 2.6%, which was below many predictions. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. Paul, we'll be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge. Now to an intriguing literary exercise. Chinese Whispers is a playground or a parlor game favorite, but what happens when you play the game with short stories across languages as disparate as Japanese, Arabic, and Hungarian and put all these stories, now shaggy dogs, a lot of them, into a book?
The answer is that you get multiples, the idea of the celebrated young British novelist Adam Thirlwell. Thirlwell has edited and attempted to control an intense game of Chinese Whispers that brings in fascinating questions on language, the concept of the ego in translation, and the joys of routes traveled by accident. Featuring a cast list of authors including J.M. Coetzee, A.S. Byatt, Zadie Smith, and Thirlwell himself, the stakes were high and the writing peerless.
Well, for this week's edition of Culture, Thirlwell swings by Studio One to tell his version to Robert Bound.
So what it is a series of stories, 12 stories in all, which each undergo generally up to about 5 or 6 transmutations into other languages. And the kind of catch is that Whereas normally your normal model of translation would be obviously that you're dealing with the original. Uh-huh. In this case, only the first translator in every series was working with the original French or Russian or whatever. Mm-hmm. And everybody else was working from a translation of a translation or a translation of a translation of a translation and so on. So that very quickly the original story gets kind of lost. And so really, I think it was a game with two things. It was really to say, you know, I'm a novelist, and in literature it's so often said that translation is kind of a nightmare, and that basically all these truisms of poetry is what gets lost in translation. Yeah.
And you say in the introduction to the book, and this is a book that we say you've edited, one of the story, you have the last story, the last word, as
the
it
last
were.
Word, yeah.
But you edit all the stories and presumably put a lot of these authors in touch and with a sort of demented magus behind the whole thing, in a good way. You're making, you should see his face. But in the introduction, you do talk about that, about the problems of translation and how the style gets across, whether or not you should be, I guess is the question, whether or not you should be entirely faithful to the words that they're reproduced or try and give a sense of the vibe of the piece.
Yeah,
and presumably your job is to do both.
Yeah, and I think it was the kind of vibe aspect that I was interested in, that obviously there were always going to be kind of problems of literal, like word-for-word problems of every language partly has some words that are just untranslatable, or there will be, especially in novel writing, there will be kind of stylistic things that a writer is going to do that are just not going to work. Like you're not going to find the right alliteration in the new sentence in the new language. But what the sort of game was to say, given that basically everything gets lost in translation in one sense, why is it that in our everyday lives and when we're reading, we're entirely happy with this notion that it's not like when you read the Penguin classic of Tolstoy, you're kind of fretting that you're not reading the original Russian. And so really, I kind of wanted to prove that our intuition was correct, that actually you could have an optimistic kind of book about translation or an optimistic book of translations. And where even things that we sort of think of as aesthetically sacrosanct, like style and form, mm-hmm. actually that kind of thing would still come across. And so I think I quite like your word vibe. It was this idea that somehow the tone or something would weirdly survive. And I think in most cases it did. I think I say in the introduction that definitely there were some unnamed series where I think the entire experiment was proved wrong. And it was an experiment. So that was the thing, that I had no idea. I certainly wasn't intending to do it at such length. And it was partly just because so many authors that I'd get in touch with or got in touch with me would be wanting to take
part. Everyone liked the idea and wanted to be part of it.
And so suddenly this thing grew from this tiny project into this much more elongated one. So some of them it didn't work, but most of the time I think, you know, I was quite happy with the results.
And the results are sort of entertaining. Some writers seem to have fretted about, as you say, maybe the sacrosanctity of the words that were handed to them and wanted to do that literal thing. But some of them, as you say, we talked about the word vibe, kind of wanted to more sort of riff on things and give it a bit of pizzazz and lift it and know that they were faking it.
Yeah,
wanted to make it readable, which is the thing. Another thing you say in the introduction is that you believe that style is the basic unit of literature, which is a really interesting thing. It's about getting the sense across, but with a readability. Is that what you mean by that?
I think what I meant was, obviously, in one sense, when you're reading, what you're really reading is the subject. You're reading for the plot or the kind of the characters. But that kind of overall, in sort of the history of literature, to put it crazily grandly, what you in the end really want is someone to just invent a new way of talking in some way. That's what deep down you remember, is the crazy formal experiments of Lawrence Stern or of Tolstoy or of Flaubert. Like, they've not just invented amazing stories, but they've invented new ways of telling them. So we did deliberately choose stories where possible that were kind of partly slightly unknown and from kind of maybe European languages no one had heard of, and where they were doing something strange with the story as a form. I think also it was this idea that therefore deep down you could actually kind of lose the plot quite literally. So one of the stories that actually I think works brilliantly starts with the first translation is by Lydia Davis, who's a fantastic American writer, very known for her fierce precision, both in her own writing and in her translations. So when she wrote to me, she wrote me a very sort of correct and stern email saying, I'm very happy to take part, but it will be a very faithful translation. I'm not going to be doing any of your kind of shenanigans that you seem to be wanting. And then what happened was it kind of went in and out of French and English and back again. And so I suddenly realized that after about three of these mutations, someone along the line, their language abilities had so kind of got it all wrong that in fact, the basic plot line of this, what was a rather harshly sort of arid story about a love affair that never happens, that apparently suddenly by the end of this story now, they actually got together. They were kind of, but weirdly, like this kind of the nostalgic tone was still there. So like something had somehow kind of gone through.
I wonder whether you feel that the job of a translator is to subsume their own ego in order to facilitate the pitch and story of the prize they get in the first place.
Yeah.
Is that the job of to be egoless?
Of a really good translator. Yeah. And I think one of the things I was playing with in this project as well was thinking, I was trying to imagine it with some of these stories as they came in, if I were the original writer of this particular story, would I be happy looking at this mutation number 5 that in one sense bore no relation whatsoever to my original? Would I really be happy if someone published that as a translation of my text? And I have to admit, in some ways, definitely, I would be absolutely horrified. But I think what I was interested in was this idea of why can't you take more liberties? And it's interesting you're talking about ego lists, because actually I deliberately excluded actual professional translators. So one of the amusements for me was, you know, knowing friends who were writers who had never in their lives considered doing a translation before and who thought they could barely speak another language. One of the fun kind of aspects for me was then persuading them, yeah, you can speak Italian well enough. I think you should do this. And then watching whether they were so not wedded to their style sounds too kind of egotistic of them. What I mean is just if you've spent your life kind of developing a manner of writing, like kind of honing your voice, how easy is it for a novelist to then suddenly think, oh, okay, but this novel that this story I'm translating is in a completely different voice, so can I kind of mimic that? Being translated is a very strange thing, and partly I wanted to do this because I think poets and kind of playwrights get that they're just used to their stuff that's going to be adapted or there's going to be a version of, and they kind of, as a novelist, you have this weird luxury that you pretty much assume it's going to be as faithful word for word as possible, that people would be quite horrified if it turned out that the new novel by Michel Houellebecq actually had dropped a couple of chapters and the translator had added their own chapter kind of at the end or...
Yeah.
And evidently, like, deep down, that's what you want. But I think what I was interested in was what if, you know, could there be an extra space where we could play around a bit more and kind of imagine what are the real parameters of this? Because I think, especially of fiction, the parameters are slightly too strict. I sort of feel it's such a strange object that we've produced because you can't really read it all through as if it's some anthology of short stories. For one reason is that in all, there are 17 languages in this book. So unless there is some extraordinary polymath out there.
Yeah, I want to see that
there
done.
Is no one reader, I think, who's going to be able to read the whole book. And I quite like that there's a sort of chance element that each reader's experience will basically be different and just depend on what other languages they've picked up or what they try and read.
And that was author Adam Thirlwell there speaking to Robert Bound for this week's edition of Culture, which you can catch tonight at 1900 hours London time. That's 1400 hours if you're in Toronto. Elsewhere on the show, we'll also be heading to the APTA TV conference in Sao Paulo. We'll also speak to the director of Cuba's first zombie movie. And there's live music as well from Elena Diane.
You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll be speaking with our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and on to Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 8:42 here in London. That means it's 9:42 in Madrid, where we head now for the latest newsmaking headlines.
Joining us on the line is our man in Madrid, Monocle's Spain correspondent, Liam Aldous. Hello, Liam. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you both?
Good, thanks. Shall we begin with Prime Minister Rajoy, the politics of distraction, as you put it?
Yes, well, it's been about a week now, and the word corruption has been eerily absent from the headlines. And this is because there's been a flare-up on the border with Gibraltar, which is more or less a gift to Rajoy, who's seen potentially the worth of an incident which involves the Gibraltar authorities dumping concrete blocks just in Gibraltar waters, constructing an artificial reef. And this has led to a huge reaction by the Spanish government, which have tightened border controls, which have led to huge lines and queues entering the island, and have also threatened to slap on a 50 euro entry fee into Gibraltar. So the headlines have all been talking about this kind of diplomatic incident in Spain, but I've noticed that the British papers have bumped it down to maybe the fifth story status.
Nonetheless, Cameron is still expressing his serious concern over the escalating tension there. But is a reef really going to do it?
Well, I think they're more worried about the 50 euro fee or the kind of the tax they're going to impose on visitors, which could really affect the island. But it's kind of it's a typical response, which is kind of straight out of the dictator Franco's playbook. to kind of use Gibraltar to distract the domestic audience from domestic politics. But there are still real issues at play here, because obviously this reef is actually going to cause problems environmentally. It actually stems from the fact that the Gibraltar authorities kind of tore up an agreement, a fishing agreement in 2012, which has meant that since March 2012, there's been a lot of kind of minor incidents involving Spanish Coast Guard and fishing boats. But this is the first time it's actually kind of really flared up in a big way. And the Spanish do have a kind of some worthy concerns, especially because there's more companies registered in Gibraltar than actual residents, and there's a real concern that Gibraltar is a tax haven. There's also 6,700 Gibraltar residents who also have Spanish residency who don't pay any tax at all. So they're kind of trying to steer the conversation towards the fact that a lot of the Gibraltar residents aren't paying taxes, and this is a real kind of a dagger in the heart of the Spaniards, as Franco used to say, and it still continues to be kind of a sore point for Spaniards.
And Liam, with all this attention now being placed on Gibraltar, it's obviously taking a lot of eyes off of Prime Minister Rajoy and the Barcenas scandal. Is this a bit of a pattern in Spanish politics, that when things get tough for the Prime Minister, that he maybe switches attention to another issue?
I think he would wish that was so, but he hasn't actually managed to do that for quite a long time. So that's probably why he's quite happy with to kind of use this Gibraltar incident and kind of talk it up and kind of announce measures that they probably won't follow through with. But like you said, they are trying to distract us journalists, but I'm not falling for the trick. So I would like to obviously talk about the continuing corruption scandal which embroils the government. And that's basically, there has been some interesting revelations over the past week involving the ex-Prime Minister José María Aznar, who apparently appears on the ledgers of the kickbacks, kind of the list of kickbacks. His initials appear JM, so there's a lot of speculation whether it is him or not, but Bárcenas, who's the ex-treasurer of the party, who's the figurehead of this scandal, hasn't really confirmed whether it was JM or José María Aznar or not, but there's a lot of speculation as to whether he was involved. But also some official pay slips from Bárcenas came to light just a few days ago, showing that he was paid €255,000 a year, which is actually more than Rajoy himself. So there's a lot of speculation as to why he was being paid more, and the fact that he was continued to be paid by the party even after the corruption scandal or the corruption allegations came to light. So this is raising more questions about why they didn't fire him and why he continued to be paid, whether he had a lot of information that he could potentially blackmail party authorities with.
Liam, this story will run and run, but you've highlighted another one that's a first for Spain. A Spanish mayor appointing Spain's first Down syndrome counsellor. I mean, what kind of precedent is that setting?
Well, it's a precedent in Spain, but I actually did read that the UK actually has a Down syndrome counsellor as well. So they're not the first here in Spain, but this actually happened because, connecting to the last story, the past councillor had to step down because of a corruption scandal. So the mayor of Valladolid, which is a city in Spain's north, appointed this. Her name is Angela Bachiller. And he appointed her because she had actually been working for 2.5 years as kind of an administration assistant. And he's appointed her as kind of a figurehead to kind of lead or represent the rights of disabled or intellectually disabled Spaniards. So she was visibly nervous in her first press conference, and the mayor kind of disregarded this and said that she would be nervous. Anyone would be nervous in their first press conference. But she has actually said that she believes that people with disabilities need to play a more active role in politics. So this is kind of an interesting precedent, but also is pointedly actually a consequence of Spain's electoral law, which allows mayors and party leaders to appoint anyone on the ballot. So this probably wouldn't be possible in other electoral systems, but because they can handpick the ballot, it's been made possible.
And the ruling PP party has been criticized in the past for not taking a more active policy of integration. Do you think this will go to quell some of those concerns?
Perhaps it will. It is kind of a regional city, so it's not the national government, but it is a positive move no matter which way you look at it, especially to as far as democratic representation is concerned. But there probably will be a lot of eyes on her to see how well she performs and whether it is just a symbolic move.
Liam, great to have you as always. That was Liam Aldis, Monocle's man in Madrid.
Well, in just a moment, we'll be flicking through this morning's British front pages with our editor, Andrew Tuck. But before we do that, let's listen to some music from the good old UK. This is the Svet remix of Another Love by Tom O'Dell.
And I wanna kiss you, make you feel alright. I'm just so tired to share my nights. I wanna cry and I wanna love, but all my tears have been used all.
That was Veta remix of Another Love by Tom O'Dell. You're listening to Midori House with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Phil Hahn. Time now to have a look at the British front pages with our editor, Andrew Tuck, who joins us in the studio. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello.
Good morning. How are you? Happy Monday.
I'm all right. I'm good. I'm
are you
limber.
Limbered up?
I'm limbered,
limbered
up, yes. I'm ready to go.
What have you got for us?
I'm raring. Well, we're going to start with a topic which kind of makes front pages around the world these days. It's about obesity. And this is a study looking at the obesity of British children. Some really interesting facts. We all know that the idea that if you eat breakfast, you're probably less likely to snack during the day. But some 50% of British 13-year-old boys no longer have breakfast. Now, that's obviously because they're racing out of the house in some senses, but many of them thinking that they're kind of missing a meal and probably going to control their food intake as well. But 25% of children sit still for 6 hours or more on both Saturdays and Sundays. It hints at, you know, this kind of idea that we're no longer a generation that goes out, or we have a generation rather that no longer goes out to play sport or to partake in any physical activity. And the problem is they're saying that they're looking at people in their 20s and 30s now in the UK, a huge rise in the number of people with heart disease. So it's just an extraordinary, you know, problem that we just never seem to counter. But then, intriguingly, you turn a few pages inside of the paper, and they also popped along at the weekend to Birmingham, which they held the Festival of Code. And this is for the kind of the kids who are like 10, 12, 11, who are going to be the writers of the new apps. And they have an interview with this young guy called Gerard Glowacki, who's only 11. I've got a feeling he probably sits on his backside for more than
6 hours a day.
And also it says they were tempted there with the offer of as much pizza and ice cream as they could eat.
Ooh, a bit counterintuitive.
A bit of a trade-off.
Yeah, so maybe some of these dormant, perhaps. And this boy doesn't
they're
look podgy.
They're not doing nothing this boy, if they're coding the next generation of internet startups. You know?
So you can't judge everybody by the amount of ice cream and
What strikes me, of course, is that this is just a year after the Olympics and we're still talking about how sport experienced a resurgence. And now, actually, on the anniversary, we've seen some studies come through saying, well, we actually don't have proof of that yet. Everyone loves to watch it and talk about it, but we're still struggling with some of these basic health problems.
And I think it is the cost to the country, what that means for your healthcare. We did a great story on The Urbanist some time ago, which was about a city in the United States where the mayor saw how, you know, to be honest, how fat his city was. And he made this pledge, the city is going on a diet. And he, you know, he encouraged the whole city to kind of rethink its strategy. So whether that was, you know, when they had money to, you know, build infrastructure, let's put in cycle paths and let's make better pavements. You know, we're never going to get rid of the drive-through, but can we ask them to put a salad on the menu as well? And they had a kind of ticking counter of the weight that they'd lost. An amazing attempt. And that's what you need. You need some kind of people who are kind of, you know, peer leaders who can change the attitude of young kids.
Well, some polar bears in the far north, they're not obese because many of them are starving to death.
That's not a very good, nice link, is it? They haven't just lost a few pounds, they're dead.
Well, they're finding dead polar bears from starvation, and of course this is because of melting sea ice, so it may not be good for the polar bears, but good for maybe Chinese cargo ships.
Yes.
That's a good link, huh?
Very good. On the front of the Financial Times today, they have a report by Tom Mitchell, who's in Beijing, and also at the other end of the line, as it were, Richard Milne in Oslo. They're looking at the way that China is trying to attempt to use the Northeast Passage. This would cut the transport of cargo going from Dalian to Rotterdam in the Netherlands from 48 days currently as it goes via the Suez Canal to just 35 days. And this ship set off on August the 8th, and it's chugging its way slowly around. And it may be possible now that for a few months each year, the passage will be completely open. So huge savings of cost. But what's also interesting is for safety is that currently the route that they take goes through the pirate-infested Malacca Straits, through the Indian Ocean, through the contested South China Sea. And suddenly they have a route which heads them up through much safer waters. And they're describing themselves these days as a near Arctic state.
Despite...
Not that near. But that bit's in brackets afterwards. Not that near.
Not that near.
Arctic state.
And lots of people, many people saying this could potentially rival the Suez Canal as well. Is that a real possibility?
Well, again, I think we have to kind of hold on a little bit because, you know, the way that the ice retreats, it isn't just every year it retreats a little bit more. It comes and goes. So we may have a period where the passage is more frozen. But it is certainly true that the Chinese are keen to exploit this route. Later in the year, we're going to be doing a bit of in our November issue, a big look at what's happening in the high north. And we sent Steve up to Steve Bloomford, our foreign editor, up to attend the Arctic Council. And that's where China has now kind of got itself kind of observer status, because everyone is watching what happens here. And all of those places along there, you know, Vladivostok, Murmansk, they're suddenly back in the news.
And very quickly, Andrew, you've got a story for us from Rome and pickpockets.
Take us to warmer climes.
I just thought I'd pick on this. This follows on last week. Oprah Winfrey obviously spoke out against a bag incident in Zurich, and that city had a kind of then PR disaster on its hand. Shows what happens when one person speaks out. Here, the British consul has said that Rome is a dangerous place. Leave your valuables in your hotel if you're wandering around. The mayor acknowledges they do have a huge number of pickpocket incidences. I think 203 people were arrested in the first half of this year, but he's saying actually it's no more dangerous anywhere else. It's just interesting how in this summer, lots of these cities are having to do lots of PR to kind of protect their images.
So keep your pockets safe. Andrew Tuck there with some good advice. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Danny Giacopelli. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is The Urbanist with the very talented Andrew Tuck. Very talented. I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Poppy Trowbridge.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.